Fat Segundo here. Garth Riss-Hallberg is an idealistic young author who has created a book without any agreed-upon way of reading it. There are cross-reference sections and certainly plenty of pictures. But if I'm going to dole out $20 for a picture book, I expect something more than the artsy-fartsy. You see, for $20, I could get a subscription to a magazine with pictures that are pleasing to the eye and, after about 15 minutes of strenuous physical activity, sticky to the touch. Our young loving correspondent wasn't nearly as up in arms with this as I was, but he certainly took issue with the inner content.
Okay, so I'm here with Garth Riss-Hallberg, who is the author of A Field Guide to the North American Family. Garth, how the hell are you doing, sir?
I'm doing a lot better since I had this Guinness put in front of me.
Ah, fantastic. I have a Guinness in front of me, too. Well, I wanted to actually ask you first about all of the uppercase bolded T's in this, which seemed to me a certain homage to Mark Danielewski. I'm wondering, is there a specific purpose to this particular bolded uppercase T's, or what's the deal with this?
Are there bolded uppercase T's?
Yes, all the uppercase T's in this are bolded.
Fascinating. The designer must have slipped that in there without my knowing. I didn't notice this.
Really? You mean to say that you have authored a conceptual book and you have abdicated all of your particular talents to this designer then?
In general, yes. Design is not my forte.
Well then, did you have any input whatsoever in the design? Or?
I had a veto power. I was sort of a benevolent, doddering, kind of Reagan-esque president, and there was a kitchen cabinet of designers, and I would kind of wander in and look over shoulders and go, yeah, that looks good, or, I don't like that. And
But you didn't notice the uppercase T's.
I didn't notice that they were bolded. I'm fascinated by that. It might just be an artifact of the typeface. It's like a Caslon typeface, and they may have just printed darker.
Did you have any input on the typeface? Or?
Originally, what I had done is the book was modeled on sort of turn of the century. I guess you can't say that anymore. Turn of the 19th to 20th century. That's so awkward. Sort of field manuals for bird watchers or wildlife enthusiasts. And we had gone back and dug up a 1911, I think the year is, a birding book called The Gallinaceous Game Birds of North America. And if you look at those old books, they have these sort of very serifed fonts. They're kind of anti-minimalist in their design. And I wanted in some way to preserve some continuity with that concept. So I'd requested an older looking serifed typeface, and this is the one they came up
with. So you're saying the North American Family is basically urban wildlife then? Or?
I think that's the conceit of the book, through this variety of vignettes and photographs, you are taking a kind of pseudo-scientific point of view on the family and all its many incarnations and with all its problems, and I think that allowed for a little bit of detachment to balance some of the kind of intense and even borderline cliched emotional content of the book. So I like the way that those two, detachment and involvement kind of were counterposed against each other.
Well, given the cross-references and you had no input in the design, how did you actually cross-reference all the particular things, or was that done by random, or did you actually just go ahead and let the designer do it? I mean, what did you actually do on this book? I mean, it seems like you only wrote the text, and that's about it.
Well, that was the cross-references were actually something I had written. So there's a curious backstory to how this book came into being, if you're interested to hear it.
Yes, I'm very interested in hearing it.
Okay. So originally this was commissioned by a literary magazine in the Bay Area that had published a story of mine, and they came back to a bunch of contributors and said, we'd like you to write a small book for us with no further instructions. It was just, we had the next prod. This was kind of at the height of the McSweeney's vogue for, every issue of every literary magazine has to be doing something whimsically different from the one before. And I think there was some intention in the backs of their minds to make the next issue be a kind of boxed set of books. And I'd had this title kicking around in my head for a while, and some kind of discrete pieces of what would become the story. And I sat down, and in about a month and a half, I kind of banged out this weird book. It was, I think at that point, it was something like 60 different chapters. They were alphabetized by heading. Each of them used a slightly different voice or kind of formal constraint. They were all cross-referenced, so I wrote the cross-references. They all had captions, and I wrote all the captions. And I was envisioning in my naivete that it would be easy to do four-color illustrations, you know, 60 or 70 or however many of them. And I think, in fact, that the editor and publisher of the literary magazine were both under that impression as well, which kind of goes to explain the fiscal origins of the magazine imploding.
Which magazine was this?
It was called M, E-M.
M?
M.
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 M. I never heard of this magazine, and I was in the Bay Area, actually, at the time.
This was...
Was there only one issue, or...?
No, there were, I think, six before they folded, and they were actually working kind of somewhat closely with the McSweeney's folks. So if you've seen the last issue of McSweeney, which has the dos-a-dos binding, that was M issue 3-4 about 5 years ago, had that. And I guess Dave was learning some book art stuff from these guys. But anyway, so I didn't think...
Learning or plagiarizing?
I think learning. I think...
You think he just stole them outright? This like this hapless literary magazine, just gut it, take its ideas?
Well, actually, issue one of M was called a staggering work of heartbreaking genius. And, you know, I think we all know what became of that. No, I think it was honest learning. There aren't actually too many book arts practitioners around. So I think that Dave had become interested... This is right around the time that...
Dave, are you on first name basis with him now?
Well, no, I like to kind of do that. I mean, Gore Vidal is Gore to me. And
you haven't actually met Dave Eggers.
I did once at this sort of M...
You stood in line and waited for him.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so he's Dave after waiting in line.
Yeah, I had him, you know, kiss my baby and tattoo my left breast with his autograph.
Umberto and I talk about this all the time.
But anyway, so this magazine folded... And I didn't really think about this manuscript again because, frankly, something in the 16 to 20,000 word range, that novella range, is utterly unmarketable. And then I got a call from the editor of this literary magazine, you know, in August of 06, last year. And he said, I've still got this manuscript. I'm now the managing editor of this art book press, and we want to branch into fiction, and I want to do this, and we can actually, you know, put some money into this thing and go wild with the illustrations and the design. So,
go wild. Was there anything more specific, or was it just a matter of just full blown feral design?
At that point, it was just the full blown feral design, but the cross referencing concept and the captions and the text and kind of the way everything was put together verbally was already in place. And what was missing was the illustrations, and it wasn't apparent to me at the time, but what would become kind of the full blown feral design element is actually the product of the designer, a guy named Chris Salyers. So I can't claim responsibility or credit for any of the cool sort of the different papers that it's printed on. And those.
This is interesting to me because, I mean, the field photographers, I was wondering if you were prioritizing one over another because some of the photos take up the whole page. Some are compressed into half a page, which made me sort of think to myself, well, some field photographers are going to kind of be upset or maybe have their feelings hurt because you didn't actually extend the photo across the page for each particular thing. So this was not your doing, this was the designer?
Well, that works in a funny way, actually. You'd be surprised to learn. The images that take up a full page are what's called full bleeds. I've learned all this terminology through doing the book. And
you could teach a class.
Probably shouldn't. Wind up with a bunch of, you know, well, maybe they'd be better than this one. But So unless the aspect ratio of the image matches the aspect ratio of the page, you have to do some cropping. And in general, my finding was that photographers were more wary of having their images cropped, even if it would mean that they appear at a larger size, than they were having the picture sort of sit in the middle of the page, but with no cropping. But I got to be the good guy in this case, because I would kind of go to the designer and go, you know, this is a little much. We need to scale back and respect this photographer's vision and not do so much cropping. So I got to be kind of an advocate for all the photographers that I'd recruited, which was important to me because basically people contributed, I think it's 44 or 45 photographers, some of whom are, you know, well into their fine art careers and had absolutely no incentive to upload images to the website we'd created for the book, and were really incredibly generous with their work. So it was important to me to treat the images as though they were as integral to the book as the words. Meaning, if there had been a design element that, you know, covered up half of one of the chapters, I would have been, you know, resistant to that as well.
So the photos were not in any way an influence upon the little text snippets. These were all came in advance. That's what I'm getting at. There was no indication in the beginnings of where you had, did you have any visual references, or did you just kind of just write this thing all out of cloth? I mean, I'm just trying to determine exactly what the visual nature of this was, how early that came into the equation.
Well, the idea that there would be illustrations was always there. And for me, the idea that they would be photographs was always there, four color, you know, full color, beautiful photographs, because I guess I had kind of a latent, some kind of latent interest in kind of William Eggleston and post-Eggleston, you know, the point at which color photography becomes an actual, you know, recognized art form. A lot of that stuff just really appeals to me in a way, because they are the photographers, I think, are kind of still the black sheep of the art world, partly because of the economics of it. It's because, you know, you can print editions of 100, it's much harder to sell a single photograph for $10 million or whatever. So they kind of lack some of the, or for some reason, they, for color photographers of, say, the 70s and the 80s seem to me to be working outside of some of the market pressures that have made for a relatively tame literary fiction environment in the U.S. So I'd always had some kind of affinity to that, and I just, you know, photographs of, like, you know, Eggleston does these great ones of, like, just tricycles and above-ground pools and, you know, people in, you know, gas stations and just the kind of the undiscovered country of America. That was what I wanted in the book. And my friend Chris Eichler, who has six photographs in the final product, I had been after him back when this was still a literary magazine piece to shoot 60 whatever photos and to be the sole illustrator. I didn't really know enough about photography to realize that in order to get 60 pictures, you know, a good photographer will shoot 800 and edit down from there. So it's like huge time commitment, huge money commitment. And my friend Chris is also incredibly slow. So at that point, or at the point that the project resurfaced, I had pretty much decided this needs to be a bunch of different artists, and maybe I can go around and, you know, go to galleries, people whose work I like, I can just ask if they'll submit an image or two. And I knew the kinds of things I was looking for. I wanted to avoid some of the heavy advertising-influenced visual irony that seems to be kind of au courant in certain photographic circles these days.
You had, like, the materialism photograph has the supermarket.
Yeah, I think that that's I like that photograph. That's a guy named Brian Ulrich. He has a book of photographs called Copia, which is kind of about consumer culture. But what I love about his work is I think that he really dignifies the people in it, and something about, I don't think that he laughs at the idea that we have, you know, four kinds of lettuce in the supermarket. He's taking note of it, which is important. And I think measuring some of the distance between, the copiousness of American culture with the relative paucity of food in some place like Honduras, but I don't think he's sneering at his subjects. And so I tried to steer somewhat clear of that. There's another image in the book. It's one of the only full frontal faces you see in the book is of an old man. And it's by a guy named John Gittleson in Chicago. And there is something kind of charming and funny about this old man, but at the same time, in the way that those photos of Beckett, the wrinkles on his face have such dignity, this looks like a real person and not just a cartoon or someone being made fun of. So I like things that steer clear of the lowercase I irony.
Oh, I wanted to actually ask you about the vulnerability photograph. You're actually inviting readers to cut up the book and to actually destroy it. And I'm wondering if this is kind of a way for you to sell additional copies of this. And there's also no cross-references there. So what happens here?
It actually is a brilliant marketing scheme on my part. It's kind of following in the steal this book, Abbie Hoffman thing.
John Butts lost in the Funhouse.
You're on to me. No, actually what that is the woman who shot that is an artist named Catherine Gass. Her father is William H. Gass, the novelist.
Yes, I know.
And he's, I don't know, because I feel like he's kind of undeservedly a footnote to some of the discussions of,
But you've mentioned him in various, all the interviews I've listened to, you keep name dropping Mr. Gass, so,
Well, I'm impressed that you've done so much homework.
I'm sure also that the listeners here know who William Gass is.
Well, that speaks...
There's no need to sneer, sir.
That speaks very well of your audience, I think. But if you do know William Gass, which I, know that you do and am hoping some of your listeners do, and anyone who doesn't, I'm inviting them to get to know him a little bit better. There's a great... this guy, Steven Schenkenberg, just started a site called Tunneling, which is devoted to... Devoted to William Gass. Anyway, so he was one of the first kind of metafictionists to do this kind of textual play and to really explore the design possibilities of fiction. I mean, at roughly the same time that Barthes Lost in the Funhouse had the Mobius strip story. But naturally, though his daughter is a photographer, she gravitates toward photographs about books and book culture and book stuff. And this was basically her image. It's a composition. It's hard to describe, but it has like matchsticks on it. It has some instructions and perforations for readers to cut along. And
someone argue that this is nepotism. Some effort to really get in favor with Mr. Gass.
Oh, I already slept with him, so I need to make no further efforts. No, he's actually an old... I used to work for him. So that's how I got in touch with his daughter. Because it had text on it already, I felt like I didn't want to besmirch the... I didn't want to throw some of my own text on top of it, and that's why it doesn't have cross-references. But I liked... Towards the end of the book, it really... part of the challenge for designing the books and curating the photographs was to kind of keep the reader off balance, because... In any of these formalist experiments or these kind of quasi-Olympian things where you're setting rules for yourself, the danger is that the reader catches on to the rules and all of a sudden they go, okay, I know what's coming next. So to throw in those full bleed images, or to throw in an image that has directions on it and dotted lines to cut along, I think just kind of keeps the reader surprised and hopefully engaged.
I have to ask about why the families are named after writers, with the exception of Hungate. You have Conroy, Russo, Harrison, or is it Shepard?
Harrison.
Yeah, Harrison. So I was thinking Jim Harrison. So I'm wondering, was this auctorial surname theme? Why did Hungate stand out as the, and it's also the one that seems to be referenced in all these many various pieces.
As purely, because I've got a weird subliminal thing on my part, I'm sure. I actually wasn't specifically trying to dig. It's funny because the authors that you point out share names with the characters are not authors that I've really read. So I haven't read, it's Frank Conroy, right? He's the, is that Stop Time? Is that his book? Yeah. So I haven't read Frank Conroy. I've read one thing by Richard Russo. I haven't read Jim Harrison or Catherine Harrison. So I think that that's either accidental or subliminal, you know, only graduate students know for sure.
Then what of Hungate?
Hungate is actually the name of a craft shop in the town I grew up in, and I don't know, it sounded nice, so I reached for it.
Yeah, I wanted to actually also ask you about the habits sections. There are two sections devoted to habits. One is habits bad, and one is habits good. And for habits good, you actually have crossed out text along with the sentence, "There is no such thing as a good habit." Now, is this you, Garth, speaking, or is this the four characters that are speaking?
I think this is the sort of authorial persona speaking. So I'm not sure if that's true or not, but, you know, the kind of whatever implied omniscient organizer of the book exists, that's, you know, that's a kind of omniscient voice speaking.
You're omniscient then?
Yes.
And you have good habits or bad habits? Just nothing but bad habits?
I have both. I'm kind of a creature of habit, and it is not something I like or admire about myself. I wish I wasn't quite so much, but and maybe that's, you know, where "there's no such thing as a good habit" comes from.
I have to ask you about the street cred of this book. There's a lot of smoking, drinking, cannabis smoking, but you stop just short of full-blown sniffing cocaine, heroin, speedballs, shrooms. What happened here, Garth? Why did you go up to a certain limit? You didn't go beyond that threshold. Do you have proper street cred here? Or?
I don't know if it's so much a matter of street cred as, you know, I may have been laboring under the write what you know delusion. And also, there's a kind of, there's a way in which a young writer, especially a young male writer, which is who I was at the time. I'm now an old woman writer. But there's a way in which...
I thought you were a middle-aged girl.
There's a way in which young people can throw in drugs, can rely on drugs, guns, general depravity to make an otherwise uninteresting piece of fiction seem gripping. And I think it's a learned tendency from movies.
And death, Garth, too.
And death, yeah. Indeed. And except I think that death is a little bit different. Death and love, I think, you know, there's that kind of awkward Harold Brodkey title, "The World is the Home of Love and Death." But at the very least, I think that death and love are more universal experiences than drugs and guns. However, when I was a teenager, you know, I did a lot of drugs. But I myself had stopped short of the... I had my rule that I wouldn't do anything white if it wasn't, you know. Anyway, not to get too much into that, but
no Oreos for you, sir.
Right, exactly.
No sniffing glue.
So I guess I personally didn't have the street cred necessary to write convincingly and persuasively about, you know, there. One of these characters may well, you know, drive off into, you know, to California and become a heroin addict, although God forbid, I hope better things for him, but...
That's a pretty bleak forecast. Was this Lying Tommy that you're talking about?
Yes, that's Lying Tommy, and that's merely a possibility, you know, one of many possibilities that exist for him, but...
But it's unwritten, so it could be anything. I mean, you're not an optimist here.
It's kind of... I think for me to kind of... pass judgment on his fate is a little bit like the Dumbledore is gay thing. You know, once the book ends, I think, you know, the characters' lives become open books, but certainly a character has been on kind of a trajectory into the darkness of drugs. One of the unwritten possibilities for him would be that he, you know, descends into addiction, but that's not the book I wanted to write.
But you have some street cred by having some drugs and smoking and things like that.
Just enough. And I name-checked The Who.
You did. In fact, you name-checked The Who without even referring to my generation.
Yeah, so were this 1973, I would be drowning in street cred. As it stands currently, I think I'm, you know, probably lacking.
Okay. Well, I also wanted to ask you about the fact that this book is called A Field Guide to the North American Family, and yet these two families are in New York. So I'm wondering, given that there's a certain kind of provincialism to being in New York, whether this actually speaks for the entire North American continent. What's the Venn diagram, sir, between New York and North America in terms of the family unit? Or am I looking at this far too closely?
Boy, I think that's a really good question. I mean, I think that's something interesting about letting a book go out into the world is you know, it's entirely possible that someone reading this in, let's say, Detroit might go, you know what, this is bullshit. This isn't my experience at all. And as a writer, you know, I'm kind of winging it. I would have had to devise a kind of Finnegan's Wake construct in order to set the book in all of North America. You know, the characters would have had to be 1,000 miles tall to occupy that kind of space. So I had to choose a setting, and I actually didn't grow up on Long Island, but I am just kind of, I used to call it the land of the above ground pool. You would fly in over Long Island and you would see these pools set like little turquoises in the landscape, and something about, I just felt that this was the platonic ideal, used in the value neutral sense of, you know, what it was to be middle to upper middle class white American family with, you know, two working parents or one stay at home and, you know, more cars than there are people in the family and all these things. And granted, that's not, that's probably not even the experience of the majority of people living in America, but it's just kind of authorial faith on my part that, you know, people will be able to connect to it despite the setting.
Is that why the families both have two children? Is that the closest thing to 2.2 children that you can get?
I think I wanted some kind of symmetry. Yeah, it is, I think. And I wanted some kind of symmetry between the families. And honestly, at that point, well, the characters kind of came to me the way they are, but that's kind of a cop-out. I mean, I think also at that time, if I had tried to make one family have 7 kids, I would have had a hard time managing that as a writer. Things get infinitely more complicated just descriptively the more characters you have in a room. And also I wanted this kind of neat symmetry between them, even though they take, you know, different paths. And 2 just felt like the natural number. I have 1 sister, so I come from a family of 4, and it made sense. No, sorry.
Oh, no. You can keep on going.
I can keep on rambling? Well, I'm trying to think of what the biggest, I mean, the biggest family I have written about, because I've written fairly often about, you know, the nuclear family unit, and I think that the biggest family I've ever written about has 3 kids, and 1 of them is dead. So, 2, for some reason, maybe, you know, there's some kind of, I don't want to sound too pretentious here, but maybe I'm just hung up on, you know, the family of 4 because I grew up in...
Well, you could even go further because you have Frank Harrison die, and I had to think here that this was sort of a possible response to penis envy, the way that Tommy reacts to him. I mean, maybe Tommy is having a sort of gender issue. Freudianism as well.
Can you remind me of what penis envy is? I think I've always been confused on penis envy.
It's like when the girl lusts after the penis of her father. It's the sort of reverse, you know, like Oedipus and penis envy.
Okay, so when he dies, that would be a wish, like what, penis envy wish fulfillment or something?
Yeah, you have to either destroy your father so you can have the penis, or you envy the penis, or something along those lines. I'm thinking I'm mangling it just a smidgen, but that's kind of sort of what Tommy faces. But he's not a girl, he's a boy. But then again, he could very well be by lying about his existence. I mean, maybe also the fact that he lies about these various things could in fact mean that he is using imagination. And you have that under, I can't remember which chapter, but it was a disapproving noun. And maybe there might be some coping mechanism here for him.
Oh, I think that the lying as a response to loss is definitely a coping mechanism. And I've actually known Lying Tommy is a composite of several people I've known, and one who I didn't, who is actually called Lying Tommy, which I just thought was a great name. That's all I want to say about that.
Definitely. Okay, no problem. Well, in security, you suggest that cheerleading practice actually results in a healthy glow. Do you have any personal evidence for this? Why did the healthy glow of cheerleading practice sort of stick out in this section? It certainly stuck out for me because I've seen cheerleaders come back from practice and they don't always have that healthy glow. So why did you, Garth, have this healthy glow described in this book?
Something about the character of Lacey, who is the cheerleader, she seems to always be ensconced in a healthy glow to me, and that sounds kind of trite, but in a way, she's the least afflicted of these characters, and again, I think that I have an image in my head of someone I went to high school with who was just kind of, again, this sounds trite, but she was kind of the all-American girl, and she was happy and functional and emotionally available and friendly and just a genuinely cool person.
But no healthy glow. You haven't described that.
Well, and she had an extremely healthy glow.
Okay, really? I mean, how could you can you elaborate on a healthy glow? What kind of healthy glow did she have, and how did this actually get from, 10 years later into this book?
Do I use the phrase healthy glow?
You use the phrase healthy glow. That's why I'm so excited about it.
I guess it is sort of an exciting concept, the healthy glow of cheerleaders. I don't know. I just, people who smile and actually mean it and aren't, I think sometimes in communities of writers, communities of self-styled intellectuals, communities of disaffected neurotic New Yorkers, etc., we have a tendency to look at people who have the healthy glow or who genuinely smile and mean it as being somehow spiritually inferior. And
or maybe she just got lucky.
Maybe she does get lucky.
Yeah.
At twice, at least, in the book. So, yeah.
I wanted to actually ask about your sentences. They average about 2.5 lines, and there are a lot of commas in your sentences, Garth, and I wanted to find out, to ask you about these lengthy sentences, and do you feel that commas help the reader? That they actually provide a way to sort of get through 2.5 lines of sentences, or one sentence actually in 2.5 lines?
Well, what do you think?
Well, I'm asking you. You're the writer. You're the big guy here.
Well, I do tend to write long sentences. I like long sentences. I think you can do a lot of things in them. I'm especially attracted to lists and to sort of slightly syntactically adventurous sentences that hold a little something off the end. And I actually think I was more interested in that 4 years ago when I was writing this book than I am now, in a way. Like, I think the longer a piece is, you write a novel and all of a sudden the pressure on every sentence to be interesting in and of itself abates a little bit because you have so many other things to hold your interest, and too many, totally mind-blowing sentences can almost be distracting from the big picture. But at that time, I think I was convinced that short sentences were the coward's way out.
Oh, but you have phrase sentences, though. I mean, you're actually quite comfortable with just phrase sentences, but you can't actually do a short sentence that isn't a phrase. So have you working on this fear of short sentences?
I would love to be able to write with the kind of diamond hard compactness of Beckett, but I just can't quite manage it. I think I don't think that way. And it's possible that if you transcribe this interview, you would find that everything out of my mouth is about, 45, every sentence is 45 words long.
That's okay. Every sentence I say is often 45 words long. I actually wanted to ask you about how can Jackie half watch TV and half watch her sleeping brother? This is very interesting to me. Again, we're talking about compartmentalization. Is she really half watching? Is she using each eye separately, or what's the situation here?
Oh, I think that I think it's more a background and foreground thing than a a wall-eyedness, or I'm sure there's like a Star Wars character who has eyes on stocks and can actually half watch things. But you know, I think that's a writer's shorthand for, you know, her consciousness is half one place and half another.
I'm wondering why you chose half watch twice.
Probably parallelism. Just you know, you mean like half watching TV and half watching her brother?
Yeah. Why didn't you just describe the TV in the foreground, or the TV in the background, and the brother in the foreground?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure I can answer that question.
Verbs were of a greater comfort than foreground and background, or did you feel that the design elements in this book pretty much took care of all the visual territory that you need to explore in this book?
Well, there's a danger in, and sometimes you'll find someone like Updike indulging in this. There's a danger in over description. There you can, you know, if you describe a face, you never want to describe the eyebrows. I mean, this is just my little tick. Or if you are describing the eyebrows, don't describe anything else, because if you give the reader too complete a visual picture of what's going on, it becomes almost impossible for them to synthesize it, and also there's no way in for the reader. You know, there's nothing left for them to imagine. And I guess this book, it asks the reader to do certain things on a kind of macro level. You've got to figure out for yourself, you know, how do these images connect to the, you know, is this literally the lamp that's in the room that's being described in the chapter? You can choose to decide for yourself what order you want to read the chapters in, because the cross references provide for that. And there,
I did the math on that, and it's something like 23 trillion different combinations. If you were to do, there's 62 different in segments. So 62 with the exclamation points, like 23 trillion, I think. That it could have been more zeros than I'm tracking, but
I'm going to buy you a beer for that. So I basically wrote 23 trillion books, which is pretty exciting. I don't know that compares to, you know, you've seen Raymond Queneau's Sonnet Machine. I was such a dork. I mean, I was just really into all this stuff in college. You know, all of the kinds of mid-century, you know, let's mess up the novel things. But so on this kind of macro level, I think the design does ask the reader to do a certain amount of work. And I find as a reader that on the micro level of the sentence, I prefer to be asked to fill in certain things for myself. You know, I don't want to know the color of every character's hair. You know, if the hair is a significant moving piece of the scene, you know, if hair is catching someone's eye, in a crowd, you might want to describe the color of the hair, but if it's just an authorial tick that every character has to be given, assigned a hair color, an eye color, you know, a quality of tooth whiteness, and that has to be transmitted to the reader. I mean, the author may know that, but the reader doesn't, it's not all useful information for the reader.
And yet you're hostile towards geos. You have Gabe's Geo, his secondhand Geo, and I have to ask you, do you feel hostility towards the Geo as a vehicle? Did you have any personal experience with Geo? Because Gabe, he's pretty indignant about the Geo during that one section.
Well, the Geo is made by the Chevy Corporation of America, so I think that speaks for itself. It could have been a Cavalier, you know, but there are only a certain, you know, select number of cars that will really ring the crappiness ringtones that need to be rung sometimes. So
you do feel hostile towards the Geo?
Absolutely, absolutely.
What did a Geo ever do to you?
It's like a two-stroke engine. I mean, you could get three of your closest friends and steal a Geo by lifting it up and carrying it down the street. I'm thinking of the little, like, you know, Geo Storm. Just not a big fan of the Geo.
I can hear that, and I read it in the book, and now I'm hearing it in our conversation. I wanted to actually ask you about the plastic bag in the sacrifice photograph. Why did this plastic bag, it's perhaps American Beauty, perhaps, I don't know, but it seemed to me a sort of assault upon plastic bags, for surely this plastic bag could be reused by someone instead of sacrificed. So there was some additional level at which the plastic bag was actually working on in this photograph. Sort of vaguely materialist, vaguely we're going to hell in a handbasket, vaguely this plastic bag will wash into that center of the Pacific Ocean where all that waste has been allowed to accumulate. It's the size of Texas. You know about that?
Well, it may have been, maybe it was a tip of the hat to Ian Fraser's great series called Bags and Trees, which I don't know if you've read, but this is actually the time of year. We're sitting here, it's early November when the leaves fall off the trees and the trees expose the bags that they've been harboring all year to the elements. And Ian Fraser is an anti-bags and trees crusader, and he's actually built a device, kind of a huge, I picture it as like a pole with a claw where he can snatch
a grabber, yeah,
bags from trees. So I think he probably feels about bags and trees the same way I feel about the Geo. That said, I didn't snap that picture, so that may be, I think the woman's name is Alexis Pike, that may be her personal preoccupation, but the image just spoke to me. I like the colors, and has some kind of loose connection to the material picture you alluded to earlier of the grocery store. You know, I like the idea that certain elements in the pictures you can imagine being related to elements in other pictures.
Now, some of the aspects of this book, you have postcards and you have fake library slip at the very beginning. You have, you know, stamps, urgent, throughout this book. Now, you described at the very beginning of this conversation that you had basically abdicated all of this to the designer. And now I'm going to see if I can actually go ahead and draw this to a magnificent cycle here. Back to the beginning. Did you have any input on this kind of stuff whatsoever about fooling the reader like that? Because I was looking at this hoping for some sort of additional texture, but I got the very, you know, quite soothing texture of the pages, but I was hoping for that flap of the library slip, and I didn't get it, Garth. I didn't get it at all.
You're like the bird who flies into the plate glass window.
Wile E. Coyote, yeah. It's like the Roadrunner trick, you know?
Well, yeah, again, as with the cutting out the page of this book, there was no kind of fool the reader impulse on my part. But what we had come up with is I originally had pictured this as being a very spare kind of design. I very much wanted that typeface. I only pictured the typeface in my mind. And then Christopher, the designer, said, here's what I found. And I was like, that's beautiful. That's perfect. But I was thinking, you know, very still, you know, white pages, text always in the same place, picture in the middle of the page thing. But that was also when it was being conceptualized as a one artist book. And as it turned into a thing where you have 45 people submitting different images of various styles. And I mean, I think they're all very distinguished images, but they're clearly, you know, a set of diverse sensibilities. And I think both Christopher and I and my editor, we all felt that somehow the design concept could help account for that heterogeneity of the image. And so in a weird way, this is kind of a jujitsu move, but the idea was, well, let's make the design a little more heterogeneous. Let's pretend that this is an old field guide, but that's been passed through many hands. It's been in a library. Someone's put their, you know, there's a coffee ring on one page. There are little postcards that have fallen into the, you know, into the binding. And
different colors, too, on the pages as well.
Exactly. And, you know, different, all sorts of different textures. And Christopher Salyers, the designer, really went nuts with that in what I thought was a really tasteful way. I had some misgivings. I got nervous at a certain point. It's like with this bonanza of images and design things and text, you know, is this all going to cohere into a story for the reader? And I can't really answer that. And it's an anxiety I still feel. But I know that when I've encountered the kind of textual disturbance of a photograph in a Zabald book, which is, I was reading a lot of Zabald when we were editing this, and or when I've encountered the kind of textual disturbance of Gass's The Tunnel, which is a, you know, like there are literally a couple of homages to that book in this one, like the page that seems to be printed on a paper bag and the coffee ring, that those things excite me as a reader and tend to bring me in and to help make the fictional world rather than detract from it. And I have this theory, which is probably totally bogus, but I've come up with it just because it sounds like a good talking point, that like as digital becomes a more viable platform for text, that increasingly pressure will be put on books to justify themselves as objects, to justify taking up your shelf space. You know, I mean, there's always been, you know, justify me paying $25 for this book, but
or $20 for your book,
or $20 for my book. But what I hope is, I hope, you know, I'm not going to be writing another book like this, another sort of design intensive book, and I hope that I hope the prose in this book and the characters and the story are enough to justify it on their own, but. I think a kind of really average and undistinguished piece of literary fiction with no prose interest, no character interest, no plot interest, you know, it's like, put it online. Let's get rid of the charade of, bothering to put out these books that are destined for obscurity. And at the same time, maybe there will be more of a movement toward recovering the materiality of the book and more people doing interesting, you know, design or image or illustration. Have you seen the Myra Kalman book, The Principles of Uncertainty?
No, I haven't.
That's a gorgeous book that Penguin just put out. And conversely, you know, sometimes I will shell out $23 for a hardcover. I'm an inveterate hardcover reader, and the book weighs about as much as a paperclip and is printed on cheap paper and seems about to fall apart at the seams. And, you know, I just feel a little bit, I just don't understand why that, just email me the PDF, you know.
So you would rather actually read something digitally than experience a book that is inferiorly produced then, and that you think that the publishing industry is running a big racket or something?
I think I'm just playing devil's advocate there a little bit, I don't like reading things on a screen in general, but one of the salutary effects of, I will never be an ebook reader, okay, but one of the salutary effects of the possibility of the ebook may be that there will be the books that actually do come out in hardcover will have to be doing so for some reason. You know, this is a book I want to read more than once, which is always, if there's a book I want to read more than once, that's something I want to buy, that's something I want on my shelf. If there's a book that's a beautiful object, that's something I want to buy, that's something I want to put on my shelf. If there's a book that is so exquisitely well written but so excruciatingly traumatic that I can never read it more than once, but I'm just comforted by the idea that that book is near me, that's something I want on my shelf. But a book that doesn't stick with me, is cheaply made, doesn't look good, isn't well written, I don't know that it would be a huge loss for those things to be published in ebook form. Or books that are so timely that, you know, books of kind of pop journalism that you want to read at the time, you want to know what's going on with Al-Qaeda, or you want to know something about the presidential election, but you don't necessarily want, I don't need Bob Wood. I have a special closet for those books. I buy them, God knows why, but I think Bob Woodward, Plan of Attack, I could read that on screen and lose nothing.
But you don't said that you don't read books on screen. I mean, certainly there's an attrition rate with the retina looking at a screen. After a while, you start to sort of see nothing but white.
But in the case of Plan of Attack, that might not be a huge loss.
Ah, okay. Well, Garth, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.